This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is the Niskanen Center's Brink Lindsay, whose connection to Reason Magazine goes back decades and who for years worked at the Cato Institute. His new book is called The Permanent Problem, The Uncertain Transition from Mass Plenty to Mass Flourishing, and it raises important questions about life in the 21st century. Thanks to capitalism, he argues, we've essentially conquered poverty, but is progress and growth slowing down? People in advanced economies like the United States are increasingly pessimistic about the future. Populism is on the rise, and many social indicators are trending in a negative direction. We talk about how to restore economic and cultural dynamism, his intellectual journey, and what a brighter future might look like. Here is The Reason Interview with Brink Lindsay. Brink Lindsay, thank you for taking the time to talk to Reason. It's very nice to see you.
It's great to be with you, Nick.
All right. So the new book, The Permanent Problem, The Uncertain Transition from Mass Plenty to Mass Flourishing. In the book, you talk about how we have achieved a kind of mass prosperity, but not mass flourishing. And I want to get to mass flourishing, both what that looks like and how we might achieve it. But first, let's talk about this mass plenty or mass abundance, mass prosperity. What is that, and how unique is that in kind of human history?
So it's absolutely worth starting off here, because the achievement of mass plenty is a world historical achievement of the first order. It is a dramatic, transformative change in the human condition. What we're talking about here is moving the threat of severe material deprivation from the sort of a core concern of human life to being off in the shadows and more of a marginal sort of tragic misfortune rather than the grim norm for an overwhelming majority of people. So from the inception of our species until an eye blink ago, the vast majority of people were living pretty much right at the edge of subsistence, where a stretch of bad weather or something like that could bring them to outright privation. So starting around the late 18th century with the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain spreading to the Second Industrial Revolution in the United States, this economic miracle of the Industrial Revolution, what Deirdre McCloskey calls the Great Enrichment, gained momentum, took off. I would say in the United States in the decades after World War II, we had for the first time in human history a mass society in which most people could take the fulfillment of their basic material needs for granted. The baby boom generation born after World War II was the first generation of humans ever raised with that kind of entitlement.
Yeah, and you are a boomer.
I'm a late boomer.
Sorry,
I'm a late boomer.
As am I. I was born in 63, so caught the tail
62.
End of that. Did you ever, just to kind of put some details on that, and you do in the book, but I'm curious on a personal level, like your parents, did they ever talk about what it was like growing up, whether they remember the Depression or whatnot? But like my parents were born in 1920, in the 1920s, they were both children of immigrants. They were poor. And that, every once in a while they would be, I grew up in a smallish tract house in New Jersey, but they would be like, and they didn't use these words, but it'd be like, holy fucking shit, the amount of stuff we have compared to what we grew up with. It would just boggle their minds every once in a while. Did your parents ever talk about what it was like?
Sure. My parents grew up during the Great Depression and World War II. So they had tales of privation. My mother's mother, who lived in town and I was very close with, she lost two brothers and her dad before she turned 18. So to illustrate that this is not just an American story, but a global story, my wife, who is Thai, her father was one of 17 boys and girls. And then he had two daughters and a son. So there you had the demographic transition in one fell swoop. But
Yeah. So are there people who still seriously challenge the idea? You know, and obviously we can talk about this as a North American story or you know, a Europe or OECD nation developed economy story or a global story. Is there anybody who is seriously making the case that no, we are not in a new world of kind of mass affluence?
Sure. There are plenty of people that are ideologically resistant to giving credit to capitalism for enriching us. Right. They say it's a sham because it's ecologically unsustainable, or all of our riches were heaped up by exploiting and taking wealth away from people in the global South or something along those lines. So yes, I would say this should be a fact that like every school kid knows, like we learned about, you know, in 1492, the Columbus sailed the ocean blue. It should be this just totally ingrained thing that the world was poor and got rich in the last couple hundred years. And yet it's still, I think, pretty counterintuitive to a lot of people.
You do a fantastic job both of documenting the extent of how much, how much people are beyond subsistence wages or, you know, subsistence living and whatnot. And you talk about how it's the Industrial Revolution and capitalism broadly discussed. How in previous works as well, you talked about globalization as part of the engine that drove all of this. Globalization seems to be in bad odor these days among people on the right and the left, certainly in American politics. Can you talk a little bit about how globalization was not, you know, and at times it was a force of exploitation and oppression? I mean, if Belgium did not treat its colonies particularly well and things like that. But overall, this was a system that really spread prosperity. Can you talk about how, what are the other effects of globalization besides kind of spreading wealth and productivity around?
Well, those are huge effects. So we've seen just since 1990, I'm not sure if I had the stats exactly right, but absolute poverty globally, that's people making less than a dollar or so a day, was something between 35 and 40% of the world in 1990. And by 2015, it had dropped to 10 to 15%. So this is an absolutely dramatic uplifting of humankind in an incredibly short, compressed time span. So, any process involving large numbers of humans is going to have, you know, nastiness and bloodshed and selfishness, but it's also going to have ingenuity and heroism and cooperation and those put the whole globalization story well in the black as far as human welfare is concerned.
And there's people like Homi Karas at the Brookings Institution who focus not just on the global poor, but on what he calls the global middle class, where he says for the first time, starting about a decade or so ago, 50% roughly, or maybe a little bit more, of people around the globe are middle class, meaning that they, after they pay their basic, nut every month, they have money left over. And he argues that this is really radical because middle class people tend to demand different things from their societies, both directly and indirectly and whatnot. So there's all of that. Why do you think, and I don't want to divert from the larger theme here, but why do you think in contemporary American politics that globalization, 25 years on from, the creation of the WTO and a kind of broad-based success. I mean, you wrote for Reason. You were at the Cato Institute at the time, but in the 90s, there was an argument about freer trade and globalization, that it would be good for people. It seemed like, in 2000, that argument had been won and we could, we can put that in the bank and not worry about it. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Yeah, so for a lot of different reasons, and not globalization foremost among them, the globalization era, say from the 80s until the present, has been an era where people at the top, well-educated professionals, managers, have done a lot better than less educated, what was formerly the blue-collar workforce. So the people that ultimately would have, you know, that would have occupied factory jobs that mostly were automated away, not outsourced away, but they disappeared, and nothing as good nothing respected, provided the kind of social foundation for a good quality of life like the old blue collar lifestyle had. And so it's much more intuitive to blame mm-hmm. bad things on other people than on a process like automation. To blame it on foreigners, that's even more, epistemologically convenient.
Works every time, yeah.
So, and then, we have seen, or we did see, a real connection between globalization, economic development, and democratization for a number of decades. And we had hopes that this process would apply to China as well. China is the biggest story in the globalization era, but growing wealth in China has not cashed out in democratization. On the contrary, they've reverted from a kind of bureaucratic oligarchy to one man rule for life. So things have regressed politically. So that has left a bad taste in people's mouth as well. But there's a general discontent that's quite widespread. That's what the book is all about, and it's globalization makes a convenient fall guy.
So let's talk about the discontent that the book really is about, and it is to kind of focus, I guess, a bit on the United States. After World War II, we have this rising mass affluence, and Tom Wolfe, in his great essay, "The Me Decade" or "The Third Great Awakening," talks about how by the 70s, regardless of people's income, everybody could kind of live a similar lifestyle. They could dress similarly. They had the same things. Rich and poor people got divorced at the same rates for the first time in human history and things like that. What is it about, the mass affluence that has caused so much, kind of pessimism now in the United States?
Well, first of all, it's raised our expectations. We've moved the goalposts as to what constitutes a successful life. Once upon a time, just keeping privation at bay, that was a real accomplishment. You could take real pride in it. During the industrializing era, work was much dirtier and more dangerous and much lower paying than it is today. But people en masse were escaping poverty, and they could feel it. It was, you could almost see the changes unfolding before your eyes. And so to make that qualitative leap from material privation to material plenty, that's going to happen one time. Now you can keep heaping up plenty and sort of adding bells and whistles, to a well-lived life, but it's just not the same thing. So the capacity of material improvement to revolutionize your life sort of diminishes. Because what was happening during the industrializing era is that economic growth was filling deficits, material deficits that prevented you from living a fulfilling, enjoyable life. You were hungry. You were physically suffering. Things were massively inconvenient. Things were unbearably, soul-crushingly boring. So the comforts, conveniences, and entertainment that capitalism provided were filling these holes in your life. Now the holes are filled. And to get from there to a real high quality of life, the bells and whistles are nice, but they're not the ball game. The ball game is something you have to do for yourself. Flourishing is effortful. You have to make the right choices to develop your capacities, to make something out of your life, to connect with other people, to invest in those relationships, to do the work that it takes to have a satisfying life. And
But at the same time, if I may, because I agree, and you know, I've been turning over this idea that I call the agony of abundance. You know, that right now what we have is, you know, it used to be people were upset because they didn't have enough. Now we have so many choices, so many options. It's hard to prioritize or to connect. And like you, I think, you know, part of this is economically determined because, you know, if you don't have, you know, if you have to work 80 hours a week, you don't have a lot of time to, you know, kind of gaze at the stars and wonder what the good life is. But you also talk, there's an economic determinism in your work where you talk about how economic growth is slowing down, and, you know, particularly over the past 40 or 50 years, rates of innovation seem to have slowed. Can you discuss that and how that factors into, you know, the current malaise that you're describing?
Yeah, so I think that's a subsidiary problem. So the primary central problem that I address in the book, which I call capitalism's crisis of inclusion, is this weakening connection between economic growth and overall well-being. We can get into that. So even if materially we continue to be better and better off, people want to turn the current malaise into an economic problem, that people are worse off than before. That's just not true. We're all materially better off, overwhelmingly so. But there are ways, important ways, in which we are sort of spiritually worse off, that the conditions, the conditions for our souls, for the nurturing of our souls, are less favorable than they were in the past. So that's the biggest problem. Then underneath that is the subsidiary problem, that the capacity of the system to continue delivering economic growth has been sputtering in recent decades. And this I call the crisis of dynamism.
Right. And economic growth matters because this is the one way that seems to be proven to constantly increase living standards.
That's the only way we know how. Yes.
So talk about the crisis of inclusion, because you're you know, in another way, and one of the stories that you tell is how much more inclusive the economy is in terms of, you know, and I think we're both old enough to remember this at a time when, you know, most colleges on the East Coast, you know, the older colleges, including state schools, like I'm wearing a Rutgers t-shirt. Rutgers College did not admit women until either 69 or 72. But like, you know, women were locked out of the workforce. Yes. All kinds of minorities were either locked out of certain workforces or, you know, just heavily discriminated against. So in a way, capitalism has become more inclusive, certainly, in terms of whatever jobs I want. Yeah.
Yes, in certain dimensions, absolutely. We've seen real social progress since the 1960s with the mainstreaming of women in economic life, with much, you know, greater opportunities for Blacks and other ethnic minorities, you know, much more tolerance for sexual minorities than in the past. So there's a lot to be proud of in the record of the past half century or so. On class lines, I think we have seen a new divergence. So you're right. By the 60s or 70s, the old class divisions had gotten quite blurry. A new class divide along educational lines started rearing up in the late 70s, early 80s, and has continued to grow. And we're now seeing real divergence in a whole host of major contributors to a good life. So the odds of getting married are much lower if you're not college educated. The odds of being raised in a two-parent family are much, much lower if you're outside of the well-educated elite.
Matter. I mean, just to make sure people understand your argument, you're not arguing this from a kind of Republican conservative family values argument that, you know, God said, you know, a man and a woman should get married, be fruitful and multiply, but rather that there, you know, you say there are specific economic
I'm saying Homo sapiens is a hypersocial species that we need other people. You deprive a baby of human contact, it will fail to thrive and maybe even die. You put an adult in solitary confinement for long enough, he will go insane. So we need other people. And the connection between a man and a woman that produces new people is, you know, foundational to society, right? You can't maintain a social order unless you produce the next generation to keep it going. And we've kind of forgotten how to do that.
I want to talk about fertility a little bit in depth in a second. But I mean, you're also saying, you know, we work fewer hours than we used to, generally speaking, but we're not filling that, that new leisure time with hypersocial human activity. It's being diverted into something else.
We're more and more sitting alone in a room staring at a screen, right? That's becoming more and more attractive. But that's a short-term dopamine hit. Our long-term interests in flourishing require that we be connected to other people. And so I think a number of us are being distracted by consumerism's glittering short-term opportunities. So we have better access to nutritious, healthy food than any humans have ever had. But we gorge on junk food and 40% of us are obese. Maybe, Ozempic will come to the rescue. Meanwhile, we now have, thanks to the internet and now AI, we have all the world's information right at our fingertips. And yet in the past couple of decades, raw IQ scores are actually falling.
How worried should we be about that, though? I guess I ask this in the sense of, I assume different people have different levels of brains, right? Like, I mean, sometimes you meet somebody and you're like, oh, this person is really smart, et cetera. But like modern IQ tests are, 100, 125 years old or thereabouts. Is that a measure that we should worry about?
Let's use it. IQ is one of the most, robust variables in social science. Mm-hmm. Its connection to good life outcomes is stronger than just about anything we know how to measure. So it's important. Beyond that, more qualitatively, we have reports from professors without number, even at the most elite institutions, who say that their students simply cannot handle the reading loads that were common in our generation. So attention spans, anybody with any kind of self-awareness who lived in the before time knows that our attention spans have been shot by phones and by the...
My question is,
developed habits. So the generation growing up natively to this may be cognitively impaired in a way that's truly a setback.
Right. I mean, I struggle. I have two adult sons. And one of them in particular, I'm thinking like he's just not a reader, but he's really smart and he consumes a vast amount of information that he shares very well. And some of the time I worry when I start to be like, the kids these days or the young adults these days, like how do you check that, you're not deeply encoding your preference or your experience and saying like, oh, well, the world is different now and different is better.
That's the ongoing conundrum that I've been facing in thinking about these things and writing this book and writing the Substack that generated the book is that I have, I think there's a number of different, dimensions in which things are going to hell. And I think there's a number of different dimensions in which we can say, oh, kids these days. And yet I'm saying these things at precisely the age in which it is completely stereotypical for people to think that things are going to hell and for them to roll their eyes about kids these days. So I'm constantly asking myself, is it me or is it the world? I'm sure that I'm grumpier about it because of me. There are objective facts out there in the world of indicators of well-being that are going in the wrong direction, and I'm not making them up.
Can you, at a couple of points in the book, you reference among a bunch of figures that we, I think, grew up recognizing as preeminent intellectuals, public intellectuals who most people don't give a shit about anymore. But Daniel Bell is one of them, who wrote a very influential book called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism. And he was a non-Marxist, and I guess at that time was shifting from being a man of the left to a neoconservative, one of the original neoconservatives.
I think he called himself a liberal in politics, a socialist in economics, and a conservative in culture.
Yeah. And he talked about, and I think about him a lot, and I always am checking myself, like, people like him and Christopher Lash and Irving Kristol, these are they had something very important to say. And I don't know if I want to keep saying that because I invested in reading their work and taking it seriously. And like, boy, you know, sometimes I feel like somebody who studied Russian, you know, got my doctorate in Russian in 1991. And it's like, you know, maybe it's not as important as it used to be. But you talk, you know, Bell in the cultural contradictions of capitalism. And I think this is alive in your work. And it's worth discussing that capitalism kind of creates the seeds of its own destruction in ways that you're talking about, where it's like we have more leisure time. But then instead of using that leisure time to connect with people, and you also you bring up E.M. Foster's great line at the end of Howard's End, the great modernist kind of ethos of only connect, that like capitalism has given us all this free time and all this cool shit, but we're not using it to connect with other people. We're using it to weaken our ability actually to be very productive in all sorts of literal and figurative ways.
Yeah, so that's going on. There's also another dimension to this class divide that I think really is highly pertinent to the shortfall that we're not getting to flourishing. And that is that because of the changing structure of economic production, the growth of this large professional and managerial class, and the stress on, you know, on abstract knowledge as being the key to, you know, economic value during this most recent era has opened up this class divide. So not only are important elements of a good life, like growing up with your mom and dad or finding somebody to fall in love with and marry, not only are those things becoming less available, but even like life expectancy is diverging between the less educated and the highly educated. So we're seeing real divergence in there's, you know, increasing class-based residential segregation. People live in their own bubble. The professional managerial elite lives in its own little sort of residential bubbles. So there is a real disconnection that leaves the majority feeling on the outside looking in, when there were only a few, you know, a tiny number of, you know, college boys you didn't, you know, you could look down on them. You could think, I'm a normal Joe. But when, you know, half of people go to college and a third have degrees, you feel like a loser if you're not part of that elite. So that elite is now large enough that the people on the outside, it's an invidious comparison being on the outside in a way that it wasn't in the past.
Yeah, and in a way, you also cite Robert Putnam, best known for the Bowling Alone kind of thesis and later book on that a lot of the intermediary institutions or cultural institutions that kind of lionize blue-collar work or non-elite work, those have all kind of frittered away. So that this adds to the sense of dispossession or alienation on the part of blue-collar work or formerly blue-collar workers who may be, you know, who are probably almost certainly doing better materially than the typical auto worker in 1960, but they feel a psychic loss that is powerful and palpable.
And yes, so, you know, in the 20th century, the common man was lionized. So the socialist movement saw him as the protagonist of world history, right? And the capitalist world was scared of socialist revolution. And so was, you know, bending over backwards to try to convince the working class that capitalism worked for them as well, right? So, but there's just nothing like that anymore, right? There's no Diego, you know, Rivera heroic murals for Walmart greeters and call center workers, right? It's just the status of ordinary work because objectively, the work that ordinary people do today is just less important to the system's overall progress and health than it was in the past. In the past, technological progress, the progress of the capitalist system depended upon large inputs of brute physical labor. So this was, and it was this dependence that was at the root of the industrial class conflict. That class conflict was very volatile, right? It produced a socialist movement, which produced totalitarian communism, which produced the Cold War, which produced the threat of nuclear annihilation. That's some serious instability. So now we have a class divide that's the complete mirror image rather than based on the dependence of progress on dirty, dangerous work. It's now based on the fact that progress no longer needs the inputs of ordinary people. Progress now, what was formerly done by factory workers has either been automated or it's been outsourced to poor countries, so that in rich countries, technological progress is basically a game for highly trained specialists. So the contributions
right. I mean,
that
this
ordinary
is
people...
Tesla. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah. If you're working at Tesla, you probably, you know, you might have an advanced degree, but you certainly are coming at it. You know, you're in the upper 1%, not just of income, but of intelligence, however we measure
right.
that.
Right. So workers and their bosses were together in the same companies on the front lines at the frontier of technological progress. And now most people are just kind of shunted off into the economic backwaters of retail and personal service. And they're just, and so that's a different, that there's nobody's fault. We're victims of our own success, but it's still produced discontent.
These fears of life becoming more kind of rationalized, bureaucratized, managed by elites. This is also something, that this was a pervasive issue in mid-20th century intellectual life. People worried about that, and they also saw how it wasn't just the assembly line that was being rationalized and ruled by, you know, brutal overseers that required either union or government intervention to make things better for workers. But increasingly, this was the critique of working at corporations like, you know, IBM and Xerox right. and AT&T and all of this. Is that, and yet at the, and I'm thinking of, there were kind of old school liberal, not even, certainly not libertarian, but kind of classical liberal critics like Arthur E. Kirch and others who really railed about this, that, you know, that American life was becoming so kind of conformist and regimented. I mean, you know, and you see this right. and I realize now you and I think are, you know, understanding a series of reference, and a lot of people might be, what the fuck is going on here? But the House Little Boxes, you know, the song
yes.
Little Boxes, which was really about churning
the theme
out.
Song for Weeds. So some people yeah. may have seen that a decade or so
right.
ago, right?
Yeah. And what was funny about that is that it was ironized in Weeds, because each episode it would have a different cover version, and it was showing this Orange County development, the ultimate bland, suburban, mass-produced, affluent society. And obviously every house was dysfunctional in its own way. So it's this is a recurring fear. And I guess my question, again, to just to push on this a little bit, is that, you know, is life more managed now than it was 50 years ago or 70 years ago? Because I feel, and you know, if I just, sorry to be yapping so much, but when I look at the life that my parents led, and I'm one generation, literally one generation removed from urban ghettos on the East Coast. And so I realize my experience is maybe typical or it may not be typical, but my father's life and my mother's life, they had very small scope for autonomy. They had very limited, you know, options in life. And then I have a lot. And then when I look at my adult sons, they have a ridiculous amount of options. And I agree with you. It's like where both socially as well as kind of work-wise, et cetera, it seems like you can't move anywhere without somebody giving you a ticket or telling you you're wrong or saying that's not the way things can be done. But on another level, it's, you know, the post-war era in America is one of, you know, of rising pushback against conformism and into a kind of new individualism
yeah, so
that oftentimes
I think,
gets accused as being the problem, right? That we're all atomistic individuals.
I think the conformism worry was particularly acute in the 50s and into the mm-hmm. 60s. So during the Cold War, in the aftermath of World War II, people were really worried about totalitarianism and the threat right. of it and the possibility of its, you know, domestic rise and the conditions for, you know, politics going in a terrible direction, that the phenomenon of mass men, you know, mass man, this sort of atomized cookie cutter interchangeable, fungible people that stood naked in front of an all-powerful state, right?
Or a corporation, right?
Yes, that's right. So I think the 60s and 70s pretty much blew those concerns out of the water, right? So we had a romantic rebellion against against that kind of conformism, and you know, so the whole you know, information technology revolution was born out of that anti-conformist spirit, right? The famous 1984, you know, Macintosh ad comparing IBM to Big Brother, right? So, so we're in
and
a new era.
And it is great to think of that, you know, Apple in a way and Microsoft too, like they are the anti-IBM, right? And IBM, all the salesmen were exactly the same thing. They followed the same script. They were all men. And it's like we are creating the mirror of their, you know, their corporation. So it's less hierarchical, but we're all wearing the same clothes. And to pretend that Apple doesn't have a conformist culture, you know, every bit as much as kind of repressive probably as IBM. Yeah, you kind of got to stretch to believe that.
So managerialism, I think, has asserted itself in different ways now rather than this sort of cookie cutter conformism. And it's a function of the fact that the professional managerial class is dominant in our society in a way that this group of people has never, you know, there's never been so many people like this, and they've never held such positions of power. So this is a novel kind of way to organize a society. And, you know, if you got a hammer, the world looks like a nail. To professional managers, the world looks like it needs to be managed and whipped into shape. And whatever amateurs are doing in a spontaneous bottom-up way just looks really chaotic and dumb and inefficient compared to what would happen if trained experts could come in and set up, you know, global best practices.
We see this in terms of
first, of course, we see it. You know, of course, libertarians are sensitive to the advance of managerialism in the public sector with the rise of the vitocracy and the sort of growing inability to do anything large in the world of atoms without running a gauntlet of, you know, potential veto points. But in the private sector, we see it as well. We see the HRization of corporate life. Surveillance by corporations of every keystroke and bathroom break that their employees take. And then we see on the part of professional and managerial moms and dads, this helicopter parenting in this, you know, sort of grim struggle to squeeze every drop of spontaneity out of childhood in the name of safety, right? So this is going on.
Or just optimization, right? I have a 3-month-old, and before I started, I was logging, you know, a diaper change and how many ounces of formula he had this morning. So things, you know, get rationalized in all sorts of ways. And that's, you know, it's not to make him safe, but it's to make sure then that he gets the extra IQ point of whatever, you know, that extra ounce of formula, which is chemically, you know, fortified now to do better than whatever we might have been raised on.
So the thing is, consumerism is always telling us to outsource, right? Go, you know, whatever you need, you can go buy it and it'll make you happier and give you a better life. Managerialism, so these are the two great, you know, forces of modernity, markets and bureaucracy. And managers, you know, they see the world as filled with helpless people that need their supervision, right? So both consumerism and managerialism are in tension with an independent agentic individual who's the master of his own, you know, desires and, you know, has real autonomy, real self-control, self-mastery, and is able to exert agency in the world. A person like that makes managers nervous, and a person like that may be frustrating to marketers. And there's nothing wrong with consumerism, and we need managerial efficiency in a lot of domains in life. But we also need other cultural forces telling us to value other things outside of those dimensions. And those forces, those cultural formations have weakened in our current era, and we're suffering as a result.
Yeah, let's talk about two elements related to that. And the first has to do with fertility rates or with declining populations. And, you know, obviously we know in the United States that particularly among native-born people, we're below replacement rate. Most of Europe is, or actually, I guess all of Europe is, and virtually all of the OECD countries, the more developed economies are. But it's also true that globally, fertility rates are declining. And you argue in the book, and I, you know, this is broadly observed, you know, this is problematic first and foremost, because if when you start to have declining populations, it's hard to have growing economies. If you don't have growing economies, you ultimately have falling living standards and things like that. But what do you, I mean, is there an explanation? Well, I guess two questions. One is there an explanation that gets us beyond just kind of lamenting the fact that, you know, as women, and I'm thinking of a book that Jonathan Last, who at the time was at the Weekly Standard, is a conservative writer. He's now at the Bulwark, the super anti-Trump rump. You know, it's fascinating to think that the Weekly Standard, you know, split into kind of the Dispatch, which is like anti-Trump, and the Bulwark, which is just anti-Trump. But Last in his book, what it was What to Expect When Nobody's Expecting, you know, basically said that I wish, you know, fertility rates would grow up, but it's basically it's modernity. Whenever women, you know, fertility rates decline as women gain more years in education, which is a proxy for more equality, which has been happening around the world. This is a good thing. Nobody, I think, and certainly neither you or I would be interested in reversing that. Right. But what can possibly be done to reverse that?
So, you know, it's just in the last couple of weeks that Paul Ehrlich died, author of the infamous The Population Bomb, where he was predicting, you know, mass starvation because of overpopulation. So by the time he wrote that book in 1968, we were a few years past peak global fertility, which was 5-point-something babies per woman. So now globally, we're probably right around the replacement level of which globally would be around 2.2 or 2.3. Every rich country except Israel is below replacement rate. Asia is falling off a cliff. South Korea is 0.7. That's the lowest. Taiwan is running neck and neck with them right now. But that means that that 100 South Koreans born today can expect to have 10 grandchildren. So that's a 90% wipeout in two generations. Here in Thailand, where I live, it's about 1.1 or 1.0. So, which, you know, that's the generation gets halved every time. So the United States, we're at like 1.6, 1.7, which is, you know, below 2.1. We also can attract immigrants we're not attracting them these days, but we historically attracted them.
And we're mostly arresting them, right?
That's right.
If
we can revert to anything like our historical pattern, then we are not going to have to worry about actual population declines.
For a while.
That's right. For a good while.
If we keep immigration going, I mean, that's
what I mean. Right. So if we keep immigration going, we're going to be fine in terms of total population.
But the world is going to
start shrinking before the end of this century. And some places are going to start falling dramatically. Already in Japan, one out of every seven houses are abandoned. Yeah. So that's weird. Yeah, you know? There's places in Europe where wolves are coming back and wildlife is coming back, right? It's happening in Japan too. Bear attacks are happening.
Is there any way to interpret that though, that is not just cataclysmic? Because, you know, and maybe that is the ultimate reality, but I mean, because you kind of work through various attempts to, you know, reverse that. It doesn't seem to work. I mean, Stalin, you know, threw money at women to have more kids, and he couldn't force it. Singapore spends a lot of money, you know, trying to get people to not just to meet up, but to mate. And
a lot of countries have tried pronatalist policy. Yeah. Some of them work, some of them drive up the birth rate some, but none of them have taken a country that was below replacement and pushed it above, right? So that the big goal has been completely elusive. So you know, who knows? We are in completely, you know, uncharted territory. This is something utterly new for Homo sapiens. So we've had local population falls and dramatic ones due to cataclysms. But generally, certainly since, you know, civilization 10,000 years ago, we've been on a steady upward population growth pattern. Then with industrialization, a huge spike in population, population growing from about a billion to 8 billion, in less than 200 years. So a huge spike, and now perhaps falling off again. It's not going to go on forever. So we're not going to go extinct. We still have populations that are churning out babies right and left. We have ultra-Orthodox Jews. We have Amish people. Amish are doubling every 20 years or so in the United States still. But I like liberal, cosmopolitan, techno-optimistic society, and I want it to keep going. And so we already see, even before population, starts to decline, the society gets older, right? The age profile changes. And really, that may be the biggest part of it. So people think, well, what's so bad about population decline? We were fine when we had 4 billion people on planet Earth. Won't we be fine again? But the age profile of the population will be completely different. It will be all old people and almost no children. And so that looks like a very unpromising, social structure for innovation. We already see from aging a real strong association between older populations and lower productivity growth, lower innovation rates.
Right. Older people don't start businesses at the same rate. We don't have, let's be honest.
Yep.
We don't have new ideas in the same way. And I guess there's some, perhaps there's some technological fix that will, give us brain boosters or something. But
I have no idea what's happening. So maybe we'll come up with really good anti-aging therapies and prolong the fertile period a long time, and also prolong longevity so that people die at a much lower rate, which will just worsen the aging problem, but will at least slow down the actual population decline problem. So maybe we'll invent artificial wombs, right? And separate, reproduction from the completely idiosyncratic individualistic choice of two people to get together and have babies, right? So we could industrialize reproduction, which is grim and dystopian, but it could happen. We could discover that culture kind of changes on a dime, that looking around and seeing a world where children's voices and laughter is getting rarer and rarer, people find that really a bummer. And some cultural groups form, which put at their heart that family and childbearing and raising a family is the most important thing that human beings can do. And those don't, right now, we have that kind of family-centric philosophy only embedded in sort of, conservative religious sects, but it could be in a secular high tech.
Or let's say traditionalist, because it's not always conservative. And in Israel, the ultra Orthodox Jews are the ones who are growing more. But generally in Israel, which most people are probably would be considered center left in U.S. terms, and they have a lot of kids.
It seems clear that fertility is contagious. So the ultra Orthodox have 6 or 7 kids per woman. Yeah. But the secular Jews are above replacement in Israel.
So let's talk about religion, because one of the things, and what I enjoy about your book a lot, besides, there's just, a mass synthesis of a lot of recent data and then your particular kind of analysis of it. But you are rich in irony. And you point out that, traditionally the types of communities that are based around religion, you know, yield better outcomes for people in terms of meaning, in terms of a sense of belonging, all of the things that feed what you call the, you know, the hyper-sociality of Homo sapiens and of people. But you admit you're not a believer yourself. And this is also something where we see globally, and certainly in the U.S., there is a trend towards secularism, a move away from organized religion, at least as we've known it in, you know, the 400 years of kind of America as a set of colonies and as a country. What, you know, is there, and would we want to hope for an actual religious revival? At one point you talk about, you know, the hopes for a new great awakening, or how do we funnel that into, you know, activities that are, you know, that get the good part of religious community or religious belonging, but not the bad stuff?
So, you know, this is very inconvenient for me as a lifelong non-believer to butt my head up against the brick wall of the facts that there seems to be no replacement for religious community in terms of really creating that sort of cohesive sense of belonging and meaning. Robert Putnam says that that praying together beats bowling together and it beats praying alone. So there's something about getting together with people face-to-face, flesh and blood, community, congregation, and we're gathered together to contemplate the transcendent. We're not thinking about the mundane, the boring. We're thinking about the ultimate things, the things that matter the most, the biggest questions in life. They don't; those questions don't have to be answered with old superstitions. We could have a religious life that isn't based on saying that some old book got everything correct. So I could imagine religious impulses manifesting in ways that don't look like the revealed religions of the past, but still answer that spiritual yearning that is in all of us.
But you're not really, I mean, you can imagine it, and maybe this is something that AI can generate, right? But I mean, in a way, I don't know if you've read Flannery O'Connor's novel, Wise Blood, but it, you know, it revolves around an itinerant preacher who creates something called the Church of Jesus Christ without Jesus Christ. And it ends poorly for everybody, you know, in the book. And you on a certain level, you talk about how, you know, the decline in religion leaves open spaces for people to start projecting other kinds of often apocalyptic fantasies, you know, like environmentalism or, you know, somebody like Paul Ehrlich. And one, not certainly not the main, I would not even say the mainstream environmentalist movement, but a large part of that became obsessed with, you know, it seemed it's a religion that is talking about how the end of the world is nigh. And, you know, scientists might as well be wearing sandwich board signs and kind of, you know, haranguing people. Having said all of this, and you lay this out, you know, you are, the book is not fully pessimistic, and you talk about how do we get to, you know, from mass plenty to mass flourishing. Can you scope out, you know, a couple of your favorite ideas, or at least how do we frame the conversation? Because this is, I mean, what I respond to in your work in general and this book in particular is, like, first and foremost, a recognition that, like, Jesus, we're in an incredible world where, like, 99% of the problems that have bedeviled humans forever, you know, like, okay, we don't have to deal with that. Now we can kind of figure out how to make meaning in our lives, how to create, you know, a utopia of utopias or whatever. And we seem to be obsessing with the dumbest possible arguments in politics, culture, you know, I hesitate to say, but you might be the right demographic for this. Waiting the last episode of a Hulu docuseries about John Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette. Like, what? Why did my, you know, why did evolution exist that I would be wasting my time, you know, on like 8 hours of bullshit about John? You know, but there it is. So, like, where do we, you know, how do we spark a different set of conversations and a movement towards mass flourishing?
Yeah, so, you know, some people have criticized me for being too gloomy in this book, but I think in context, I'm talking about that we're in this kind of weird no man's land between one world historical triumph, the conquest of poverty, material poverty, and another possible looming world historical triumph, which is making the good life, a really rich, satisfying life, widely available to the vast run of folks. So that's an amazing goal. That's even something that we can contemplate thinking about how to get there. It means we're in an extraordinarily privileged position historically. So the first thing we need to do, though, is we're not nearly rich enough yet. So our energy systems and our food systems aren't really environmentally sustainable for the long haul, particularly if we want everybody to be as rich as people in the United States are now. So we need to keep going with technological progress in cleaner energy systems.
Energy is the ultimate general purpose technology, right?
Absolutely. We've been stagnant. Energy consumption per capita has been flat since the 1970s. And there's a lot of exciting developments right now with the plummeting costs for solar and wind, and with a lot of investment and interest in new forms of nuclear and advanced geothermal. So there's lots of things that are going on. So we need to get richer to make our material, the foundations of our prosperity sustainable. But we also need to be richer because right now, yes, we can take our basic material needs for granted, but with an asterisk, right? That is, we need to spend most of our waking hours for most of our adult lives doing stuff that most of us wouldn't choose to do to pay the bills to keep those needs satisfied, right? So there is a precarity to our affluence and a necessary connection between our affluence and more or less drudgery, depending on where you are in the occupational structure. So many of us, lucky, in the elite, have jobs with lots of intrinsic satisfactions, lots of challenges, and so we can become workaholics because we're addicted to the buzz of the challenge that the work provides, right? But most people aren't in that boat. So what we want to do is dramatically expand the ranks of the independently wealthy people who can work or not as a matter of choice, like lottery winners do today. People who could retire early in their 30s or 40s, or people who could do like Keynes predicted we would be doing by now, which is working only about 15 hours a week, or maybe work episodically during different phases of your life. Anyway, but there would be a lot of free time. So what do you do with that free time? I think the thing we ought to be doing is connecting with each other. So I envision how we could get to a world where there's more, where we use our wealth to revitalize face-to-face communities, building our own places where we live, using high tech to support those efforts, becoming more sort of economically independent from the system, not because it's economically efficiently necessary, but because it gives us a sense of agency and control over our lives and gives us stuff to do together. One of the reasons why our social connections are unraveling is because they once fulfilled face-to-face relationships, once fulfilled vital practical functions. So our spouse was our partner in economic production. Our kids helped out on the farm and they took care of us when we were old. Our neighbors were they helped us against, the threat of violence. They were insurance policy during bad times, right? They were the only alternative to listening to the crickets at night for entertainment. So as we've gotten richer, those functions that used to be fulfilled by our neighbors and our kinfolk, we've outsourced either to the market or to the welfare state, and that's fine, right? But as a result, other people, those vital personal connections, which are foundational to a well-lived life, have become just one consumption option amidst a sea of expertly marketed alternatives. And all too often, we're choosing the expertly marketed alternatives. I picture a future where we've gotten rich enough to see what really matters and use some of that wealth to hive off into smaller groups. When you can live wherever you want to, you don't need to live next to your office. Then you can live with people that matter to you. And so we can see a real revitalization of community life. That's the brighter future that I think is possible.
As a final topic of discussion, You mentioned libertarian in passing. I don't know if you still consider yourself a libertarian, but could you talk a little bit about your kind of intellectual journey over years? You have a law degree, and you've worked in various places. But you know, I met you when you were a contributing editor at Reason. You know, you were at Cato Institute for a long time. You're at the Niskanen Center. Both of these are very, interested in markets and making markets flourish. In the book, you talk about how capitalism, you know, really needs to be regulated, or that it is not the thing itself. Like it is a means to an end. It's not the end in itself. Could you just, and I guess at some point, was this in the aughts? Was it the late 90s or early aughts when you, in the aughts. New Republic?
Yeah.
Okay. Where you talked about libertarianism, which was kind of a arguing that libertarians should really be looking towards, I think I'm remembering correctly, kind of like center left people as natural allies rather than a kind of,
exploring the possibilities of a left fusionism as opposed to the old standing
right wing. So
right fusionism,
I mean,
right?
You know, and it seems like, you know, what, you know, the book certainly reflects a lot of concerns and changes over your life. But how did you become a libertarian, and how do you consider yourself now?
So I became a libertarian the old fashioned way. I read it, Ayn Rand, in high school. I discovered Hayek in law school, and I switched then. I saw a different way to get to a very similar result, a way that intellectually resonated with me more. And so for a long time, I considered myself a Hayekian classical liberal. I wouldn't call myself a libertarian right now. I don't think any off-the-shelf ism it really fits me. It's really just sort of a personal sense that the world is too complicated for any of the off-the-shelf maps to be sufficiently reliable. But I still put a lot of weight on the key libertarian ideas: the suspicion of centralized power, the recognition of the enormous creative power and potential of bottom-up, unregulated, spontaneous, voluntary activity, especially when mediated through markets. Acute sensitivity to how even the best-intended government programs can go terribly wrong. So all of those things I still see as true. They're important partial truths. They're just not the whole truth in the way I see things now. So I think there is, you know, a libertarian spirit that you can see in the book. There's a concern with the sort of, you know, the possibility of individualism, a real agentic individualism being crushed by, you know, sort of wallified consumerism and brave new worldy managerialism, and envisioning safeguarding human freedom sort of not by changing the system's rules, but by moving more of life out of the system altogether. So creating that utopia of utopias in little, smaller, relatively independent communities that still depend on modern technology for the backbone, but still have a certain degree of independence. In those environments, in a much more pluralistic world where some people will be doing very anti-libertarian things, I think there will be a freedom for libertarian forms of social organization would be vitally important for the kind of future that I hope for. So right now, rather than thinking that we're going to radically change the state system along libertarian lines, I think we need to make the state system do its most important thing, which is to keep pushing the standard of living upwards while maintaining, you know, liberal respect for individual rights. And then we can we can seek our, you know, our libertarian impulses. We can seek to act on them outside the system more and more over time.
Who, both with the Substack and with the book, to the extent that it, you know, it hasn't been out, you know, that long, but who do you find more receptive or most receptive to the kind of broad arguments you're making? Because we do, I think you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, we're always in a liminal space, but we definitely seem to, and again, maybe it's just age talking here, but, you know, the old world is rapidly changing, you know, it's dissolving, and what exactly we will be in is not fully clear yet, but it seems, you know, there's a lot of conversations that are happening that wouldn't have been happening 25 years ago. Who is responding to you're talking about?
Yeah, so there's a lot of kind of, you know, green shoots of the future that I'm that I imagine. There's a lot of people are now focused on this idea of touching grass and reconnecting with the real and reconnecting with the flesh and blood. And there's, you know, there's been intentional communities for a long time. You know, America started as a religious intentional community. We had the big 60s wave of secular communes that didn't pan out. But we're seeing a new experimentation kind of started in the Bay Area with the tech crowd, but is going, you know, around the country of co-living facilities as more and more people now are remote workers. So by the 1980s, we had reached the nadir of people working from home. Only about 2% of people did. It's been going up steadily because of IT since then, and then COVID gave it a big shove. And so now we're about 20% of people work at home, which means they can live anywhere, right? So as more and more people are in that kind of boat, then they can think, well, I can live with people that matter to me. I can live with friends. I can live with family. And so those co-living arrangements, I can picture taking off because of social trends that are, you know, that have juice right now. So people involved in those things. So there's this kind of hippy dippy back to the land. We need to reconnect with people message that connects with people who are more kind of lefty in orientation, and who are kind of weirded out by my, you know, techno optimism. Then there are people who are really worried about the future of liberalism and that we're, you know, we're heading towards some sort of disaster. And so they're, you know, they're interested in any vision of the future that isn't, you know, dystopian. But then a lot of sort of allies in the here and now, you know, people who are on the center left, center right, and who are like me, sort of turned off by the populist right and by the woke left. A lot of them think my criticisms of capitalism are just too biting, and that I'm sort of playing into the hands of the populist right by complaining too much, and we ought to present a happier face to the world. But I think that's wrongheaded. I think if we don't face up to our problems, we're not going to solve them. So I've written a book that's, you know, I think there's not an obvious demographic that it lands with. It lands with kind of little groups here and there across a whole range of demographics, and it's been fun discovering those little pockets.
Well, thank you for writing it, Brink, and thank you for talking to Reason. This is the Reason interview, and I've been talking with Brink Lindsey, the author most recently of The Permanent Problem, The Uncertain Transition from Mass Plenty to Mass Flourishing. Brink, thanks so much.
Thanks, Nick.